ashes. A formation of three scout-class starfighters flew through it, watching. Falling debris was often broken pieces of ships or other space junk, and the salvage from it could be valuable. It played havoc with our radar, though, and could mask a Krell incursion. I stood in the blue-gray dust and let the awe of the sky wash over me, feeling the peculiar sensation of wind against my cheeks. I'd come up close to Alta Base, which I could see in the distance, maybe only a 30-minute walk or so away. Now that the Krell knew where we were, there was no reason to hide the base, so it had been expanded from a hidden bunker to several large buildings with a walled perimeter, anti-aircraft guns, and an invisible shield to protect it from debris. Outside that wall, groups of people worked a small strip of something I always found strange. Trees and fields. What were they even doing over there? Trying to grow food in this dusty ground? I didn't dare get close. The guards would take me for a scavenger from a distant cavern. Still, there was something dramatic about the stark green of those fields and the stubborn walls of the base. Alta was a monument to our determination. For three generations, humankind had lived like rats and nomads on this planet. But we would hide no longer. The flight of starships streaked toward Alta, and I took a step after them. "Set your sights on something higher," my father had said. "Something more grand." And where had that gotten me? I shouldered my pack and my spear gun, then hiked in the other direction. I had been to a nearby passage before, and I figured that with more exploring, I could connect some of my maps. Unfortunately, when I arrived, I found the passage's mouth completely collapsed. Some space debris hit the surface in the near distance, tossing up a spray of dust. I looked up and saw a few smaller chunks streaking down overhead, fiery chunks of metal. Heading straight toward me, scud. I dashed back the way I had come. No. No, 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 no. The air rumbled, and I could feel the heat of the approaching debris. There. I spotted a small cavern opening in the surface, part crack, part cave mouth. I threw myself toward it, skidding and sliding inside. An enormous crash sounded behind me, and it seemed to shake the entire planet. Frantic, I engaged my light line and slapped my hand against stone as I fell in the churning chaos. I jerked up short, connected by the light line to the wall as rock chips and pebbles flew across me. The cavern trembled. Then, all grew still. I blinked dust from my eyes and found myself dangling by my light line in the center of a small cavern, maybe 10 or 15 meters high. I'd lost my pack somewhere, and I'd scraped my arm up pretty good. Great. Just great, Spencer. This is what throwing a tantrum gets you. I groaned, my head throbbing, then tapped my fingers against my palm to let the light line out, lowering myself to the floor. I flopped down, catching my breath. Other impacts sounded in the distance, but they dwindled. Finally, I wobbled to my feet and dusted myself off. I managed to locate the strap of my bag sticking out from some rubble nearby. I yanked it out, then checked the canteen and maps inside. They seemed okay. My spear gun was another matter. I found the handle, but there was no sign of the rest. It was probably buried in the mound of rubble. I slumped down against a stone. I knew I shouldn't go up to the surface during debris falls. I had practically begged for this. A scrabbling sound came from nearby. A rat? I raised the handle of my gun immediately, then felt doubly stupid. Still, I forced myself to my feet, slung the pack over my shoulder, and increased the light of my bracelet. A shadow ducked away, and I followed, limping only a little. Maybe I could find another way out of here. I raised my bracelet in the air, illuminating the cavern. My light reflected off something ahead of me. Metal? Maybe one of the water pipes? I walked toward it, and it took my brain a moment to realize what I was seeing. There, nestled into the corner of the cavern, surrounded by rubble, was a ship. Chapter 4. It was a starfighter. An old one, of a design completely unfamiliar to me. It had a wider wingspan than DDF ships, and was shaped like a wicked W. Straight, razor-like wings at the sides framed an old, dust-covered cockpit in the center. The acclivity ring, the thing that gave starfighters their lift, was buried in the rubble underneath the ship, but from what I could see, it looked whole. For a moment, I forgot about the test. A ship. How long had it been here to collect that much rubble around it, and that much dust? One wing had been bent almost to the ground, probably by a cave-in, and the rear boosters were a huge mess. I didn't know the model. That was incredible. I knew every DDF design, every Krell ship, and the roving trade ship designs used by nomadic human clans. I had even studied old ships we'd flown during the first decades after crashing on Detritus. I could rattle off each of these practically in my sleep, draw their silhouettes from memory. But I'd never seen this design. I dropped my pack and climbed, gingerly, up the wing that had been bent down. My bracelet provided light as my boots scraped off caked-on dust, revealing a scratched metallic surface. The right side of the ship was particularly banged up. It crash-landed here, I thought. Long ago. I climbed up near the circular cockpit, which had a glass, well, probably fusion plastic, canopy that was remarkably intact. The ship was generations past having enough power to open its own cockpit, but I found the manual release panel right where I expected it. I brushed the dust off and found letters. In English. They said, "Emergency canopy release." So the ship was human. It must be old then. Likely as ancient as the apparatus and the rubble belt. I yanked on the release lever to no avail. The thing was stuck. I put my hands on my hips and considered breaking in, but that seemed like a shame. This was an antique, the sort of thing that belonged on a pedestal in the Igneous Ship Museum, where we celebrated warriors of the past. There was no skeleton in the cockpit, though, so either the pilot had escaped, or it had been here so long that even the bones had turned to dust. All right. Let's be delicate about this. I could be delicate. I was incredibly delicate. Like, all the time. I attached one end of my light line to the release lever, then walked across the top of the ship to the rubble at the rear, where I attached the other end of the light line to a boulder. That separated the energy rope entirely from the bracelet, which stopped glowing. The rope could function for an hour or two once separated from its power source, but would remain stuck at the length it was when released. I got down on my back, braced myself against the wall, and shoved the boulder with my feet. It started rolling down the rubble, and as soon as I heard a click from the cockpit, I disengaged the light line with a tap. The glowing rope released its holds on either end and was sucked back into the bracelet. That done, I scrambled over to find the lever pulled and the ancient cockpit popped ajar. Reverent, I lifted the canopy all the way, sending dust cascading to either side. The interior looked extremely well preserved. Indeed, as I slid down into the cockpit, I found that the seat was stiff, but the leather wasn't cracked or decomposing. Similar controls, I thought, resting my left hand on the throttle, my right hand on the control sphere, fingers resting in the grooves. I'd sat in mock cockpits before at the museum, but never in a real ship. I reached into my pocket, feeling my father's pin, which I'd recovered from its hiding place before setting out into the tunnels. I held it up, letting it sparkle in the glow of my bracelet. Was this what my father had felt? This snug sense of rightness when sitting in a cockpit? What would he think if he knew his daughter spent her time hunting rats? That she was here, in a dusty cavern, instead of sitting and taking the pilot test. That she'd folded, instead of fighting. I didn't fold, I said. I didn't run. Or, well, I had. But what else could I have done? I couldn't fight the entire system. If Admiral Ironsides herself, head of the DDF, didn't want me in, there was nothing I could do. Anger flooded me. Frustration. Hatred. Hatred at the DDF for how they'd treated my father. Anger at my mother and teachers. Every adult who had let me keep dreaming when surely they'd all known the truth. I closed my eyes and could almost feel the force of the ship's booster behind me. Could almost sense the pull of G-forces as I took a turn. A scent of crisp, clean air pulled in from the upper atmosphere and pushed into the cockpit. I wanted to feel it more than anything. But when I opened my eyes, I was back in a dusty old broken-down antique. I would never fly. They'd sent me away. A voice whispered from the back of my mind, "What if that is the test? What if they wanted to see what I'd do? Scud, what if Mrs. Vermeer had been lying? What if I'd run away for nothing? Or worse, what if I'd just proven that I was a coward, like everyone claimed my father had been?" I cursed, checking the clock on my Lightline bracelet. 4 hours. I had 4 hours until the test. But I'd spent almost an entire day wandering. There was no way I could make it back to Igneous in time, could I? "Claim the stars, Spensa," I whispered. I had to try. Chapter 5. I exploded into the testing room like a fighter with its booster on full overburn. I interrupted a tall older woman in a white admiral's uniform. She had chin-length silvery hair, and she frowned at me as I pulled to a halt in the doorway. Then her eyes immediately went to the clock hanging on the wall. The second hand ticked one last notch. 1800 hours on the dot. I made it. I was a sweaty mess, my jumpsuit ripped and stained with dust from my near encounter with a piece of space debris. But I'd made it. Nobody said a word in the room, which was located in the government buildings at the center of Igneous, near the elevators to the surface. The room was stuffed with desks. There had to be 100 kids here. I hadn't realized there were so many 17-year-olds in the Defiant Caverns, and these were only the ones who wanted to test for pilot. At that moment, every single one of them was staring at me. I kept my chin high and tried to pretend that nothing was out of the ordinary. Unfortunately, the sole open desk I spotted was the one directly in front of the woman with the silver hair. Did I recognize her? That face. Scud. That wasn't just some junior admiral. It was Judy Ivins, Ironsides herself. She was a first citizen and head of the DDF, so I'd seen her face in hundreds of paintings and statues. She was basically the most important person in the world. I limped a little as I made my way over and sat down in front of her, trying not to show my embarrassment or my pain. Dashing all this way had involved multiple crazy descents with my Lightline through caverns and tunnels. My muscles were protesting the effort, and my right leg seized up with a cramp the moment I sat down. Wincing, I dropped my pack to the ground by my seat. An aide snatched it and carried it to the side of the room, as you weren't allowed anything at your desk but a pencil. I closed my eyes, but then cracked them as I heard a distinct voice whispering nearby. "Oh, thank the home world. Rig?" I glanced and spotted him a few rows over. He had probably arrived 3 hours early, then spent the entire time worrying that I would be late. For absolutely no reason. I'd arrived with at least half a second to spare. I winked at him, then went back to trying not to scream in pain. "As I was saying," the admiral continued, "we are proud of you. Your work and preparation prove you to be the best and most promising generation that the DDF has ever known. You are the generation who will inherit the surface. You will lead us in a bold new era in fighting the Krell. Remember that this test is not to prove worthiness. You are all worthy. To field a single flight of pilots We need hundreds of technicians, mechanics, and other support staff. Even the humble vat worker is a participant in our great quest for survival. The fighter's booster or wing should not scorn the bolt that holds it in place. Not all of you will pass this test, but by simply choosing to be here, you live up to my lofty expectations of you. And to those who pass, I look forward to supervising your training. I take a personal interest in the cadets. I frowned. She seemed so aloof, so indifferent. Surely she didn't care about me, no matter how infamous my father was. As aides rushed to distribute the tests, Ironside stepped to the side of the room, near some captains in sparkling uniforms. A short man in glasses whispered to her, then pointed toward me. Ironside turned and looked at me again, her lips turning down sharply. Oh, no. I glanced toward the other wall of the room, where some teachers, including Mrs. Vermeer, watched. She saw me, then shook her head as if in disappointment. But I thought I'd figured it out. They were just trying to see if I was truly defiant. Right? An aide deliberately took a test off the bottom of the stack and placed it on my desk. Hesitant, I searched my pockets for a pencil, but found only my father's pin. At a hiss from the side, I glanced toward Rig, who tossed me a spare pencil. Thank you, I mouthed. Then opened the test and turned to the first question. 1. Explain, with examples of what is made from them, the 14 types of algae grown in the vats, and the nutritional value of each. My stomach sank. A question about algae? Yes, the tests often included random questions from our schooling, but algae? I flipped to the next page. 2. Explain the exact conditions required for optimal growth of algae, not limited to, but including, temperature, water purity, and vat depth. The next was about how sewage was treated, as was the one after that. I felt my face growing cold as I realized all 50 pages were questions about things like algae vats, sewage, or ventilation. Those were lessons I'd missed while hunting. I'd shown up in the afternoon classes for physics and history, but I simply hadn't had the time to study everything. I looked at Mrs. Vermeer again, and she wouldn't meet my eyes, so I leaned over and stole a glance at Darla Mee Bim's test. Hers had a completely different question at the top. 1. Name 5 aerial maneuvers you would perform to dodge a Krell ship that had you in close pursuit. A tight loop, a rolling twin scissor, the Alstrom loop, a reverse back pedal, and a banking roll. Depending on how close they were, the nature of the battlefield, and what my wingmate was doing. I leaned to the side and checked the test of another neighbor, where I spotted some numbers with the words booster and throttle, a question about acceleration and G-forces. An aide spoke up, loud enough for most people in the room to hear. Be advised that no one sitting next to you will have the same test. So cheating is not only punishable by expulsion, it is useless. I slumped back in my seat, anger boiling inside me. This was complete and utter trash. Had they prepared a special test for me, covering topics they knew I'd been forced to miss? As I stewed there, several students rose and walked to the front of the chamber. They couldn't be done already, could they? One of them, a tall, well-built young man with brown skin, short, curly black hair, and an insufferable face, handed the admiral his test. From where I was sitting, I could see it was blank except for his name. He showed her a pin, a special pin, blue and gold. The pin of a pilot who had fought at the Battle of Alta. Children of First Citizens, I thought. All they had to do was show up and fill in their names, and they'd be given automatic entry into flight school. There were 6 of them today, each one getting a free slot that could have gone to other harder-working students. One by one, the 6 left, and the admiral dropped their unfinished tests on a desk by the front wall. Their scores wouldn't matter. Just like my score didn't matter. Dia's words returned to me. You don't really think they'd let the daughter of Chaser fly for the DDF, do you? I tried anyway. Furious, holding my pencil so tightly I broke the tip and had to get a replacement, I scrawled on my stupid test. Each question felt intended to break my will. Algae vats, ventilation, sewage, places I supposedly belonged. Daughter of a coward. She's lucky we don't just toss her into the vats. I wrote for hours, emotions dogfighting within me. Anger fought naive anticipation. Frustration fought hope. Realization shot down optimism. 14. Explain the proper procedure if you think a vat of algae might have been contaminated by a coworker. I tried not to leave any questions blank, but on well over two-thirds of them, my answer boiled down to, I don't know. I'd ask someone who does. And it hurt to answer them, as if by doing so I was proving that I was incompetent. But I would not give up. Finally, the bell chimed, marking the end of the five-hour time limit. I slumped as an aide pulled the test from my fingers. I watched her walk off. No. Admiral Ironsides had returned and was speaking, now that the test had ended, with a small group of people in suits and skirts, first citizens or National Assembly members. Ironsides was known for being stern but fair. I stood up and walked to her, fishing in my pocket, fist closing on my father's pin. I waited, respectful, as the students filed out for the after-test party, where they'd be joined by those who had already settled on other careers and who had been spending the day applying for and being assigned positions. Those who took this test and failed would be given second pickings later in the week. Tonight, though, everyone would celebrate together, future pilot and future janitor alike. Finally, Ironsides looked at me. I held up my father's pin. Sir, I said, as the daughter of a pilot who fought at the Battle of Alta, I would like to petition for acceptance into flight school. She looked me up and down, noting the ripped sleeve, the dirty face, the dried blood on my arm. She took the pin from my hand, and I held my breath. Do you really think, she said, that I would accept the pin of a traitor? My heart sank. You aren't even supposed to have this girl, she said. Wasn't it destroyed when he crashed? Did you steal someone else's pin? Sir, I said, my voice taut. It didn't go down in the crash with him. He gave it to me before he flew that last time. Admiral Ironsides turned to leave. Sir, I said, please, please just give me a chance. She hesitated, and I thought she was considering. But then she leaned into me and whispered, Girl, do you have any idea the kind of public relations nightmare you could cause for us? If I let you in, and you turn out to be a coward like he was, well, there is no way on this planet I will let you into a cockpit. Be glad we even let you into this building. It felt like I'd been slapped. I winced. This woman, one of my heroes, turned to leave. I grabbed her arm, and several aides nearby gasped softly, but I held on. You still have my pin, I said. Those belong to the pilots and their families. Tradition, the pins of actual pilots belong to the families, she said. Not cowards. She pulled herself out of my grip with a shockingly firm yank. I could have attacked her. I almost did. The heat was rising inside me, and my face felt cold. Arms grabbed me from behind before I could do it. Spin, Rig said. Spensa, what are you doing? She stole it. She took my father's. I trailed off as the Admiral walked out with her collected attendants. Then I sagged into Rig's grasp. Spensa, Rig said. Let's go to the party. We can talk about it there. How do you think you did? I think I did terribly. Spensa? I pulled away from him and trudged back to my desk, suddenly feeling too exhausted to stand. Spin? He asked. Go to the party, Rig, I whispered. But leave me alone, please. Just let me be by myself. He never did know how to deal with me when I got like this. So he hovered about, then finally trailed off. And I sat alone in the room. Chapter 6. Hours passed. My anger before had been as hot as magma. Now I just felt cold. Numb. Echoes of the party drifted in from another area of the building. I felt used, stupid, and most of all, empty. Shouldn't I have been snapping my pencil, throwing tables about in rage, ranting about seeking vengeance upon my foes and their children and grandchildren? Typical Spensa behavior? Instead, I sat there and stared until the sounds of the party grew quieter. Eventually, an aide peeked into the room. You're supposed to leave. I didn't move. Are you sure you don't want to leave? They'd have to drag me out of here. I imagined it, very heroic and defiant. But the aide didn't seem so inclined. She switched off the lights and left me there, lit only by the red-orange glow of the emergency lights. Finally, I stood up and walked to the desk by the wall, where Ironsides had, perhaps accidentally, left the tests the children of the First Citizens had given her. I looked through the stack. Each of them had only the name filled out, the other questions blank. I took the one off the top, the first one handed in. It held the name Jorgen Waite, followed by a question. 1. Name the 4 major battles that secured the United Defiant Caverns' independence as the first major state on Detritus. That was a tricky question, as people were probably going to forget the Unicarn skirmish. It didn't get talked about as much. But it was where the fledgling DDF had first employed fighters of the second generation of designs, built in secret in Igneous. I trailed over to my desk and sat down, then answered the question. I moved on to the next, then the next. They were good questions, more than simple lists of dates or parts. Some math questions about combat speeds. But most were questions about intent, opinion, and personal preference. I struggled on 2 of them, trying to decide if I should say what I thought the test wanted or what I thought was actually the correct answer. I went with the second both times. Who cared anyway, right? By the time I was finishing up, I heard people talking outside, janitors, from the sounds of their discussion. Suddenly I felt silly. Would I scream and force some poor janitor to pull me out by my hair? I'd been beaten. You couldn't win every fight, and there was no shame in losing when you were outnumbered. I turned over the test and tapped my pencil against it, still sitting mostly in the dark, working by the glow of the emergency lights. I started sketching a W-shaped ship on the back of the test as a crazy idea began to form in my head. The DDF hadn't begun as an official military. It had started out as a bunch of dreamers with their own crazy idea. Get the apparatus working. Create ships from some schematics that had survived our crash on the planet. They'd built their own ships. The door opened, letting in light from the hallway. I heard a bucket get set on the ground outside, and 2 people complaining about spills in the party room. "I'll be out in a minute," I said, finishing my sketch. Thinking. Wondering. Dreaming.
"Why are you still here, kid?"
a janitor asked.
"You didn't want to go to the party?"
I didn't feel much like celebrating. He grunted.
"Didn't do well on the test?"
"Turns out it doesn't matter," I said. I glanced at him, but he was backlit, just a silhouette in the doorway. "Do you ever," I said, "do you ever feel they forced you to be what you are?"
"No. I might have forced myself into it, though."
I sighed. Mother was probably worried sick about me. I stood up and wandered over to the wall, where the aide had put my pack.
"Why do you want it so much?"
the janitor asked. Was there something familiar about his voice?
"It's dangerous, being a pilot. A lot of them get killed."
"Just under 50% are shot down in their first 5 years," I said, "but they don't all die. Some eject, Others get shot down but survive the crash.
Yes, I know.
I froze, then frowned and looked back at the figure. I couldn't make out his face, but something flashed on his breast. Medals? A pilot's pin? I squinted and made out the shape of a DDF jacket and dress slacks. This was no janitor. I could still hear those two out in the hallway joking with each other. I stood up straighter. The man walked slowly to my desk, and the emergency lights revealed he was older, maybe in his 50s, with a stark white mustache. He walked with a prominent limp. He picked up the test I'd filled out, then flipped through it.
"So why?"
he finally asked.
"Why care so much? They never ask the most important question on these tests. Why do you want to be a pilot?"
"To prove myself, and to redeem my father's name." It was my immediate response, though something else warred with it. Something my father had sometimes said, something buried inside me, often overshadowed by ideas of vengeance and redemption. "Because you get to see the sky," I whispered. The man grunted.
"We name ourselves Defiance," he said. "It's the central idea of our people. The fact that we refuse to back down. And yet, Ironsides always acts so surprised when someone defies her."
He shook his head, then set the test down again. He put something on top of it. He turned to limp away. "Wait," I said. "Who are you?" He stopped at the doorway, and the light outside showed his face more clearly, with that mustache and eyes that seemed old.
"I knew your father."
Wait, I did know that voice. "Mongrel?" I said. "That is you. You were his wingmate."
"In another life," he said. 0700 sharp on the day after tomorrow. Building F, room C14. Show the pin to get access."
The pin? I walked back to the desk and found, sitting on top of my test, a cadet's pin. I snatched it up, but Ironsides said she'd never let me into a cockpit.
"I'll deal with Ironsides. It's my class. I get final say over my students, and even she can't overrule me. She's too important for that."
"Too important? To give orders?"
"Military protocol. When you get important enough to order an armada into battle, you're too important to interfere with how a quartermaster runs his shop. You'll see. There's a lot you know, judging by that test, but still some things you don't. You got number 17 wrong."
17? I flipped through the test quickly. The overwhelming odds question?
"The right answer was to fall back and await reinforcement."
"No, it wasn't." He stiffened, and I quickly bit my tongue. Should I be arguing with the person who'd just given me a cadet's pin?
"I'll let you into the sky," he said. "But they're not going to be easy on you. I'm not going to be easy on you. Wouldn't be fair."
"Is anything fair?" He smiled.
"Death is. He treats us all the same. 0700. Don't be late."
Part 2. Chapter 7. The elevator doors opened, and I looked out upon a city that should not exist. Alta was primarily a military base, so perhaps city was an ambitious term. Yet the elevator structure opened a good 200 meters outside the base proper. Lining the roadway between the two were shops and homes. A real town, populated by the stubborn farmers who worked the strips of greenery beyond. I lingered in the large elevator as it emptied of people. This represented a threshold to a new life, a life I'd always dreamed about. I found myself strangely hesitant as I stood there, pack full of clothing over my shoulder, the phantom feeling of my mother's kiss farewell on my forehead.
"Oh, isn't it the most beautiful thing you've ever seen?"
a voice said from behind me. I glanced over my shoulder. The speaker was a girl about my age. She was taller than I was, with tan-brown skin and long, curly black hair. I'd seen her earlier on the elevator and noted her cadet's pin.
She spoke with a faint accent I didn't recognize.
I keep thinking it can't be real, she said. Do you think it might be some cruel prank they're playing on us?
What tactical advantage would they gain by that? I asked her.
The girl took my arm in a much too familiar way. We can do this. Just take a deep breath. Reach up. Pluck a star. That's what the saint says.
I had no idea what to make of this behavior. People normally treated me like a pariah. They didn't take me by the arm. I was so stunned that I didn't resist as she towed me after her out of the elevator. We entered the wide walkway leading through the town toward the base. I'd rather have been walking with Raj, but they'd called him in late last night to ask him something about his test, and so far I hadn't gotten word of what that meant. Hopefully he wasn't in trouble. The girl and I soon passed a fountain, a real fountain, like from the stories. We both stopped to gape, and I extricated my arm from the girl's grasp. Part of me wanted to be offended, but she seemed so genuine.
That music the water makes, she said, isn't it the most wonderful sound ever?
The most wonderful sound ever is the lamentations of my enemies, screaming my name toward the heavens with ragged, dying voices. The girl looked at me, cocking her head.
Well, bless your stars.
Sorry, I said. It's a line from a story. I stuck up my hand to her. Best to be on good terms with the other cadets. I'm call sign Spin.
Kimmelin, she said, shaking my hand. We're supposed to have call signs already?
I'm an overachiever. What room are you reporting to? She fished in her pocket and pulled out a paper.
C-14? Cadet Flat B.
Same as me.
Call sign, Kimmelin murmured. What should I pick?
Killer? I suggested. Afterburn? No, that's probably too confusing. Flesh Ripper?
Couldn't it be something a little less gruesome?
You're going to be a warrior. You need a warrior's name.
Not everything is about war.
It kind of is. And flight school especially is. I frowned, noting the accent in her voice.
Where are you from?
Not Igneous, I guess.
Born and raised in Bountiful Cavern.
She leaned in.
We call it that, but nothing really grows there.
Bountiful, I said. It was a cavern somewhat close to Igneous, also part of the Defiant League. That's where the clans from the Antioch crew settled, right? The Antioch had been one of the gunships in the old fleet, before we'd been driven into hiding here on Detritus.
Yep. My great-grandmother was assistant quartermaster.
She eyed me.
You said your call sign was Spin? Shouldn't you be something like Lamentation or Eats Enemy Eyeballs?
I shrugged. Spin is what my dad used to call me. She smiled brightly at that. Scud, they'd let this girl in but had denied me? What was the DDF trying to do? Put together a knitting club? We approached the base, a group of tall, stern buildings surrounded by a wall. Right outside it, the farms gave way to an actual orchard. I stopped on the walkway and found myself gaping again. I'd seen these trees from a distance, but up close they seemed enormous, almost 3 meters tall. Before this, the tallest plant I'd seen was a mushroom that reached up to my waist.
They planted those just after the Battle of Alta, Kimmelin said. It must take brave people to volunteer for service up here, so exposed to the air and to krill attacks.
She looked up at the sky in awe, and I wondered if this was the first time she was seeing it. We stepped up to a checkpoint in the wall, and I thrust my pin toward the guard there, half expecting rough treatment, like I'd always gotten from Aluko when entering Igneous. However, the bored guard only marked our names off on a list and waved us in. Not much ceremony for my first official entrance into Alta. Well, soon I'd be so famous, the guard at the door would salute me on sight. Inside, we counted off the buildings, joining a handful of other cadets. From what I understood, around 25 of us had passed the test and had been organized into 3 training flights. Only the best of the best would actually pass flight school and be assigned to full-time pilot duty.
Kimmelin and I soon arrived at a wide, single-story structure near the launch pads. Flight school. I barely held myself back from running over to the glistening starfighters lined up for duty. I'd done enough gawking for one day. Inside the building, we found wide hallways, most of which appeared to be lined with classrooms. Kimmelin squealed, then rushed over to talk to another cadet, someone she apparently knew. So I stopped by a window on the outer wall and looked out at the sky, waiting for her. I found myself feeling anxious. Not about the training, but about this place. It's too big, too open. The hallways were over a meter wider than those of most buildings in Igneous, and the base's buildings sprawled outward instead of being built on top of one another. The sky was just up there, always present, looming. Even with a force field between me and it, of the same invisible type that starfighters employed, I felt exposed. I was going to have to sleep up here, live, eat, exist, all out in the open. While I liked the sky, that didn't mean I wanted it peeking in during every intimate moment. I'll simply have to deal with it, I told myself. The warrior cannot choose her bed. She must bless the stars if she can choose her battlefield. A quote from Jun Mi's The Conquest of Space. I loved Grand-Grand stories about Jun Mi almost as much as I did the old Viking stories, even if they didn't have quite as many decapitations. Kimmelin returned, and we found our classroom. I took a deep breath. Time to become a pilot. We pushed open the doors. Chapter 8 10 mock cockpits dominated the center of the room, arranged in a circle facing inward. Each bulky device had a seat, a control console, and part of a fuselage built around it, though no canopy. Other than that, they looked as if they'd been ripped right out of starships. Instead of the nose cones of ships, however, each had a large box attached to the front, maybe a meter tall and half as wide. Kimmelin and I were apparently the first of our flight to arrive, and I checked the wall clock. It was 06:15. For once in my life, I was not only early, I was first. Well, technically second, as Kimmelin jumped past me to look over the mock cockpits. Oh, I guess we're first. Well, the saint always said, if you can't arrive early, at least arrive before you're late. I walked into the room, setting down my backpack and checking out the mockpits. I recognized the control panel layout. They were from Poco-class ships, a basic, if fast, DDF starfighter model. The door opened, and two more cadets entered. The shorter boy at the front had dark blue hair and appeared to be a youngin. The crew of the Young Guang, from the old fleet, had largely been from China or Korea on Earth. The blue-haired boy grinned as he looked over the room, putting his pack beside mine. Wow. Our classroom. The girl behind him sauntered in like she owned the place. She was a lean, athletic-looking girl with blonde hair and a ponytail. She wore a DDF uniform jacket over her jumpsuit, loose, like she was out on the town. Those two were soon followed by a girl with a tattoo across her lower jaw. She'd be Vissian, from Vissi Cavern. I didn't know much about them, only that they were the descendants of the Marines from the old space fleet. The Vissians had their own culture and kept to themselves, though they had reputations as great warriors. I smiled at her, but she looked away immediately and didn't respond when Kimmelin perkily introduced herself. Fine then, I thought. Kimmelin got names and home caverns out of the other two. The guy with the blue hair was Bim and was indeed a Jungian. His clan had been part of the hydroponics team on the old ship, and had settled in a nearby cavern that maintained a large set of underground farms, lit and maintained by ancient machinery. I'd never eaten any of the food from there. It was reserved for those who had many achievement merits or industry merits. The athletic girl was Hadia, from Igneous. I didn't know her, but the cavern was a big place, with a vast population. As the time for class drew near, a tall girl entered and introduced herself as Freya. It was a good mythological name from Old Norse, of which I approved.
She kind of had the look, too. Though she was skinny, she was tall, maybe even 185 centimeters, and she had blonde hair, which she wore cut very short. Her boots were brand new, polished to a shine, and done up with gold clasps. Well, that made six of us. We'd have a few more, at least. About 10 minutes before the start of class, three young men walked in together. They were obviously friends, as they were talking and joking softly. I didn't recognize two of them, but the one at the front, with brown skin and short curly hair, was distinctive in a kind of baby-faced pretty boy way. The guy from the test, I realized. The son of a first citizen who had gotten free admission. Great. We were saddled with a useless aristocrat, someone who lived in the lowest and safest of the Defiant Caverns. He'd be in flight school not because of any skill or aptitude, but because he wanted to sport a cadet's pin and feel important. Judging by the way the other two talked, I instantly pegged them as his cronies. I'd have bet anything that all of them had gotten in without taking the test. So our cadet group had three people who didn't deserve to be there. The tall, baby-faced guy walked the center of the ring of seats. How could a boy have a face that was so extremely punchable? He cleared his throat, then clapped his hands sharply. Get to attention, cadets! Is this how we want to present ourselves to our instructor? Lounging about, making idle chit-chat? Line up! Kimmelin, bless her stars, jumped up and stood at a kind of sloppy attention. His two cronies stepped over and fell into step as well, doing a much better impression of real soldiers. Everyone else just kind of looked at him. What gives you the right to order us around? Asked Hadia, the athletic girl from my own cavern. She stood leaning against the wall, arms folded. I want to make a good first impression on the instructor, cadet, Jerkface said. Think how inspiring it will be when he comes in to find us all waiting at attention. Hadia snorted. Inspiring? We'd look like a bunch of suck-ups. Jerkface ignored her, instead inspecting his line of three cadets. He shook his head at Kimmelin, whose version of attention involved standing on the tips of her toes and saluting with both hands. It was ridiculous. You look ridiculous, Jerkface said to her. The girl's face fell, and she slumped. I felt an immediate burst of protective anger. I mean, he was right, but he didn't have to belt it out like that. Who taught you to stand at attention? Jerkface asked. You're going to embarrass us. I can't have that. Yeah, I said. She'd be stealing your spot, since embarrassing us is clearly your job, Jerkface. He looked me up and down, taking obvious note of the patched state of my pilot's jumpsuit. It had been one of my father's, and had required serious modification to fit me. Do I know you, cadet? He asked. You look familiar. I was sitting in the front row taking the test, I said, when you turned in your exam without a single question answered. Maybe you saw me there when you glanced at the rest of the room, to see what people look like when they actually have to work to get things. He drew his lips to a line. It seemed I touched a nerve. Excellent. First blood. I chose not to waste resources, he said, making someone grade my test when I had already been offered a slot. One you didn't earn. He glanced at the other cadets in the room, who were watching with interest. Then he lowered his voice. Look, you don't need to make trouble. Just fall into line and fall into line, I said. You're still trying to give us orders? It's obvious I'm going to be your flight leader. You might as well get used to doing what I say. Arrogant son of a supernova. Just because you cheated your way into, I didn't cheat. Just because you bought your way into flight school doesn't mean you'll be flight leader. You need to watch yourself. Don't make an enemy out of me. And if I do? Scud. It was annoying to have to look up at him. I leaped onto my seat to gain a height advantage for the argument, an action that seemed to surprise him. He cocked his head. What? Always attack from a position of superior advantage, I said. When this is done, Jerkface, I will hold your tarnished and melted pinup as my trophy, as your smoldering ship marks your pyre.
and the final resting place of your crushed and broken corpse.
The room grew quiet.
All right, Jerkface said. Well, that was descriptive.
Bless your stars, Kimmelin added.
Hedea gave me a thumbs up and a grin, though the others in the room plainly had no idea what to make of me.
And maybe my reaction had been over the top. I was used to making a scene. Life had taught me that aggressive threats would cause people to back off. But did I need to do that here? I realized something odd in that moment. None of these people seemed to know who I was. They hadn't grown up near my neighborhood. They hadn't gone to class with me. They might have heard of my father, but they didn't know me from any other cadet. Here, I wasn't the rat girl or the daughter of a coward. Here, I was free. The door chose that moment to open, and our instructor, Mongrel, stopped in the doorway, holding a steaming mug of coffee in one hand, a clipboard in the other. In the light, I recognized him from the pictures of the first citizens, though his hair was grayer, and that mustache made him appear much older. We must have looked like quite the menagerie. I was still standing on the seat of my mockpit, looming over Jerkface. Several of the others had been snickering at our exchange, while Kimmelin was again trying to execute a salute. Mongrel glanced at the clock, which had just hit 700 hours.
I hope I'm not interrupting anything intimate.
I said. I jumped off my seat and tried a little laugh.
That wasn't a joke, Mongrel barked. I don't joke. Line up by the far wall, all of you.
We scrambled to obey. As we lined up, Jerkface pulled off a precise salute, and he held it at perfect attention.
Mongrel glanced at him and said, Don't be a suck-up, son. This isn't basic training, and you aren't grunts from the ground corps.
Jerkface's expression fell, and he lowered his arm, then snapped to attention anyway.
Sorry, sir.
Mongrel rolled his eyes.
My name is Captain Cobb. My call sign is Mongrel, but you will call me Cobb, or Sir, if you must.
He trailed along the line, his limp prominent, taking a sip of his coffee.
The rules of this classroom are simple. I teach, you learn. Anything that interferes with that is likely to get one of you killed.
He paused near where I stood by Jerkface.
That includes flirting.
I felt my face go cold. Sir, I wasn't.
It also includes talking back to me. You're in flight school now, stars help you. 4 months of training. If you make it to the end without being kicked out or shot down, then you pass. That's it. There are no tests. There are no grades. Just you in a cockpit, convincing me you deserve to remain there. I am the only authority that matters to you now.
He waited, watching to see how we responded. And wisely, none of us said anything.
Most of you won't make it, he continued. 4 months may not seem like long, but it will feel like an eternity. Some of you will drop out under the stress, and the Krell will kill some others. Usually, a flight of 10 ends up with one cadet graduating to full pilot, maybe two.
He stopped at the end of the line, where Kimmelin stood biting her lip.
This bunch, though,
Cobb added.
I'll be surprised if any of you make it.
He limped away from us, setting his coffee on a small desk at the front of the room, then rifling through the papers on his clipboard.
Which one of you is Jorgen Waite? Me, sir,
Jerkface said, standing up straighter.
Great. Your flight leader.
I gasped. Cobb eyed me but said nothing.
Jorgen, you'll need two assistant flight leaders. I'll want the names by the end of the day. I can give you those now, sir, he said, pointing to his two cronies, a shorter boy and a taller one. Arturo and Ned.
Cobb marked something on his clipboard.
Great. Everyone pick a seat. We're going to-
Wait, I said. That's it? That's how you choose our flight leader? You're not even going to see how we do first?
Pick a seat, cadets,
Cobb repeated, ignoring me. But, I said.
Except Cadet Spensa, he said. Who will instead meet me in the hallway?
I bit my tongue and stomped out into the hallway. I probably should have contained my frustration, but really? He immediately picked Jerkface? Just like that?
Cobb followed me, then calmly shut the door. I prepared an outburst, but he spun on me and hissed,
"Are you trying to ruin this, Spencer?"
I choked off my retort, shocked by his sudden anger.
"Do you know how far I had to stick my neck out to get you into this class?"
he continued.
"I argued that you sat in the room for hours, that you finished a damn near perfect test. It still took every bit of clout and reputation I've earned over the years to pull this off. Now, the first chance you get, you're throwing a tantrum.
But you didn't see what that guy was doing before class. He was strutting around, claiming he'd be flight leader.
Turns out he had good reason.
But
what?
Cobb demanded. I stifled the words I was going to say, and instead remained silent. He took a deep breath.
Good. You can control yourself at least a little.
He rubbed his brows with his thumb and forefinger.
You're just like your father. I spent half the time wanting to strangle the man. Unfortunately, you're not him. You have to live with what he did. You have to control yourself, Spencer. If it looks like I'm favoring you, someone will call improper bias, and you'll be pulled from my class faster than you can spit.
So you can't favor me? I asked. But everyone can favor the son of an aristocrat who didn't even have to finish his test? Cobb sighed. Sorry, I said.
No, I walked into that one, he said. Do you know who that boy is?
Son of a first citizen?
Son of the Jeshua Waite, a hero of the Battle of Alta. She flew 7 years in the DDF and has over 100 confirmed kills. Her husband is Algernon Waite, National Assembly Leader and High Foreman of our largest inter-cavern shipping company. They're among the most heavily merited people in the lower caverns.
So their son and his cronies get to be our leaders, just because of what their parents did.
Durgan's family owns 3 private fighters, and he has been training on them since he was 14. He has nearly 1,000 hours in the cockpit. How many do you have?
I blushed.
His cronies, Cobb said, are Ned Strong, who has 2 brothers in the DDF right now, and Arturo Mendez, son of a cargo pilot who had 16 years in the DDF. Arturo has been acting as co-pilot with his father and is certified with 200 hours flight time. Again, how many hours do you have?
I took a deep breath. I'm sorry for questioning you, sir. Is this the part where I do push-ups or clean a bathroom with a toothbrush or something?
I already said this isn't infantry training. The punishment here isn't some menial stupidity.
Cobb pulled open the door to the room.
Push me too far, and the punishment will be simple. You won't get to fly.
Chapter 9. You won't get to fly. Never had I heard words more soul-crushing. When the two of us re-entered the training room, Cobb pointed at a seat by the wall. Not a cockpit, just an empty chair. I slunk over and settled down, feeling thoroughly routed.
These contraptions, Cobb said, rapping his knuckles on one of the boxes in front of the mockpits, are holographic projectors. Old technology from the days when we were a fleet. When these machines are on, you'll think you're in a cockpit. They will let us train you to fly without risking a real fighter. The simulation isn't perfect, however. It has some haptic feedback, but it can't replicate G-forces. You'll need to train in the centrifuge to accustom yourself to that. DDF tradition is that you get to pick your own call sign. I suggest you start considering, as you'll carry the name for the rest of your life. It will be how the most important people, your flight mates, come to know you.
Jerkface's hand went up.
Don't tell me now, cadet, Cobb said. Anytime in the next few days is fine. Right now, I want to—
The door to the room banged open. I leaped to my feet, but it wasn't an attack or an emergency. It was Rig, and he was wearing a cadet's pin.
I was wondering if you'd show up,
Cobb said, picking up his stack of papers.
Raj McCaffrey? You think it's a fine idea to show up late to your first day in flight school? You going to show up late when the Krell attack?
Riggs sucked in a breath and shook his head, going white like a flag of truce. And Rig was a cadet.